Blog Talk Radio.
Well, son, I tell you, life for me ain't been no crystal stair. It's had tacks in it and splinters and boards torn up and places with no carpet on the floor bare. But all the time I's been a-climbing on and reaching Latins and turning corners, sometimes going in the dark where there ain't been no light. So boy, don't you turn back. Don't you set on the steps, 'cause you find it's kinda hard. Don't you fall now, for I still going, honey. I still climbing, and life for me ain't been no crystal stair.
Good evening and welcome to Talk Straight. This is your host, Reverend Dr. Reuben Dockery. This is a forum by which we open national dialogue about issues that confront all of us. And we hope to be able to bring instructional dialogue as well as proactive solutions to very common problems. We're grateful that you join us tonight on Talk Straight. Our topic tonight is dealing with parent empowerment, the secret to redirecting at-risk youth. Our focus specifically is in the Charlotte, Mecklenburg, North Carolina area. And our special guest tonight, who we will bring on in just a little bit, is Ms. Lori McNeil. We're grateful. We're going to try to get it look like we're having a few technical difficulties reaching her, but we're going to try again to reach her, and hopefully we can get her right in with us. Nonetheless, we thank you for joining us, and we're going to ask you if you will, if you're listening by Facebook or any other medium, we're asking you to call us here directly at the show at the appropriate time. The number is 657-383-0944. That's 657-383-0944. We're grateful, as always, to have our guest host and panelist, Reverend Ricky Waller. We're going to bring him in just a little bit as well, as we normally do, but we're going to begin by giving some context to the show. Let me see if I can get our guest locked in here before we get started. Look like we're having a little issue there. We're going to keep on trying. Amen. I wish I had a witness here. Let's see if we can, if this will help us get her there. But again, nonetheless, we will continue to reach out to her, see if we can reach her and move forward with the show. Again, as I mentioned, the show is focused largely around the conversation about parent empowerment. We believe that there is a secret to redirecting at-risk youth. Perhaps one of the most important pieces in the puzzle of redirecting at-risk youth is the parent. Often hardworking parents lack the knowledge of identifying and managing emotional challenges confronting their children. And as a result, what they find is that they cannot deal with the stressors related to some of the issues that their children face socially. And so tonight what we want to do is we want to have some honest dialogue and discussion with our guest mental health specialist, Ms. Lori McNeil. And she brings a professional perspective to the conversation about how we can help train, support, and empower parents to address those issues that we just made reference to relative to their children and some of the things that plague them. So we're hopeful that at the end of the day, again, we're able to provide some factual information, some useful information, and get everybody involved and to a point where we can see clear through some of the fog of anguish and frustration that we face. Having said all of that, let me give some sort of background and context to where we are. Let's look at Charlotte, Mecklenburg, North Carolina. According to Neighborhood Scouts, which is a search engine that helps you understand some of the demographics, economic, statistical issues related to various cities across America, they do a fairly good job of keeping up with census data and things of that nature. According to Neighborhood Scouts, Charlotte is a very large city, which is located, again, in North Carolina. And it has a population of about 809,558 people and 200 constituent neighborhoods. It is the largest community in the state of North Carolina. The greatest number of Charlotte residents report their race to be white, followed by black or African American. Per capita income in Charlotte, according to the 2010 census, was around $31,844 per family, which is considered to be relatively wealthy in North Carolina and compared to other cities in the nation. Some areas of town with the least performing schools is reported as Clanton Road and Tryon Street, West Boulevard and Tivola Street, Central Avenue and Northern Street, and Wilkerson Boulevard and Allegheny Street. Interestingly enough, where there are issues with the neighborhoods being the most unsafe, or there's indications of crime, things of that nature, according to that same report of Neighborhood Scouts, two of the areas reported as being most unsafe are correlated with the areas with the worst schools, and that is Wilkerson Boulevard, as well as Allegheny Street, and West Boulevard and Tivola. Charlotte's annual crime rate per 1,000 residents reported to be 4,880, or 6.3%, violent crimes reported in the last reporting period, and 29,163 property, or 36.1% property crimes. In addition to that, it has the highest rate compared to North Carolina as a state. North Carolina with a 3.30% crime rate, and Charlotte as a city with a 6.3%. Just about double that. Let's talk about what the breakdown appears to be, and that is a basic unawareness of civic expectations for parents, their young people, often is what we find, and the lack of understanding of how their value base for what they do and how they rear children affects their outcomes socially in society. That is not said to cast a negative dispersion on anyone, but to bring light to the circumstance. All right? Tonight we hope to draw reference to some of the that are related. Now, having said that, while we make effort to get hold to our guests here, I'm going to share with you what I believe is an appropriate song. Those who are consolate, who are troubled, who are disturbed, I hope that this will bring some comfort to you. And after which we will see if we can't bring our guests in here and our panelists as well. But let me go ahead and share with you this particular song that I think has appropriate meaning for our conversation tonight, and we'll be back on the other side. That you join us tonight. The number to call us to share your comments, ask your questions, is 657-383-0944. And we were able to get our honored guest tonight, Ms. Lori McNeil, who is a mental health specialist working in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area. Good evening, Ms. McNeil.
Good evening. How are you doing tonight?
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. We're glad that we were finally able to get you there.
Okay.
Also, I'm sorry, go ahead. What did you say?
I'm saying thank you for having me.
Okay, all right, absolutely. We're glad to have you. We also have our panelists on with us, Reverend Ricky Waller. He is a author and a powerful minister in the Nashville area. And he's partnering with us in our efforts to bring education and support for particularly young men who are struggling with finding their identity and overcoming things like gangs, drugs, alcohol, and disparity, social disparity. He is sharing with us his powerful book, Heal High. Good evening, Pastor Waller. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Thank you. How you doing, Pastor Dockery?
Great,
and how
great,
you
great,
doing?
Great.
How do you feel?
Ms.
Your name is Miss. Say it again.
Miss McNeil.
Miss McNeil,
yes.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking. I'm doing just fine.
Very good. Glad you have me.
All righty. So, Miss McNeil, let's begin. I just gave a little background for the show, and I'll recap that just for your knowledge. And I would like for you to kind of give us a little bit background about what you do every day and how you address some of the things that we shared in that are common in our efforts to do this educational piece. We are targeting 10 states, and this is actually the 11th state that we're looking at, North Carolina. And there are some things that we find to be very common. But we looked at the size of your city, which is pretty large, 809,000 plus, 200 neighborhoods involved there. We looked at the fact that African Americans is the second largest population in the Charlotte area, as well as they have a median income of about, or per capita, I'm sorry, income, about 31,000 or so, 844. We looked at two areas in particular that have low performing schools, that are low performing, and issues with relatively high rates of crime, and specifically Wilkerson Boulevard and Allegheny Street seem to correlate themselves with those two, as well as West Boulevard and Tibola, I believe it is. They seem to replicate themselves in those two areas. Then we look at the fact that the crime rate there is reported to be about 6.3% and for violent crimes, and 29,163 or 36.1% property-related crimes, and that that's about twice the amount of the state. Again, we point these things out not to cast dispersion, but to help frame the context for, as we said tonight, empowering parents with the secret to redirecting at-risk youth. Having said that, can you tell us a little bit about your what you do and your family? And, of course, Lori and I have to admit, we had the pleasure of being at Fisk University together. I'm not going to age us, Lori.
okay.
But it was many, many years ago, many years ago. but
well,
go ahead
I'm
and,
actually proud. I'm a proud. I'm very happy to tell my age because I feel as though we're not aging and we're only getting better. So we just celebrated our 25th anniversary at our beloved alma mater, which is Fisk University.
Right.
But my major there was psychology and sociology, and as presently I am currently working as a social worker with the Children's Home Society of North Carolina.
Okay.
I've been a social worker in and out of different counties for over 20 years. I've worked with various agencies in the area, including the health department, different agencies that provide mental health and behavioral health services to children and their families.
Okay.
And I really enjoy that that population. I hear every day just from some of my peers and colleagues that are not in the same industry that I am, that they couldn't do this every day. So it definitely, I know, takes a special type of person, but I really wouldn't change it for the world. I really, I feel as though it's a very humbling profession, and I am, I just think it, at the end of the night, it just makes me very blessed. It makes me feel blessed to be able to go home to my own family.
Sure.
Just because, you know, I've seen so many different things happening with our youth, and that just drives me every day to continue to do what I do.
Okay, great. You know, I was looking at your professional bio, and I saw where you spent a great deal of time working inside homes with parents and families.
Yes.
Did I understand that correctly?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, tell us how that is versus having them come to you to a brick-and-mortar facility. What's the difference, do you think, in being able to go where their realities are in terms of their home and the issues that are there for them specifically?
I think really the basis of some of these in-home types of programs give an opportunity for people who are in the profession, such as myself, to go into the home versus them trying to figure out how they're going to, you know, get transportation to some of us. And it also gives us an opportunity to you know, come into their homes on their level. Some people are not able to do that, you know, due to the fact that, you know, you're having to put your personal life out there. You know, you're putting yourself
right.
at a risk yourself by going into some of the communities. Not, you know, you mentioned, you know, some of the neighborhoods and the communities that are not thriving as well. And, you know, there's a lot of crime in some of these developments and in some of these communities. But like I said before, it gives us an opportunity to come into their neighborhoods, into their homes, you know, meeting them where they are, you know,
wow.
not being so much on a particular professional level where we're looking down, being judgmental, things of that nature. But we're going into their homes, we're building a rapport with the families, the parents, whether it's a single family home or, you know, both parents are in the home. But it's going into the home, identifying the goals that have us there in the first place. And some of
yeah.
these things are just, you know, dealing with a child who's not doing so well in school, finding
mm-hmm.
out what's going on, what has been some of the positives, what have been some of the negatives,
wow.
and trying to meet
okay.
that person where they are to establish goals.
Mm. You know, Pastor Waller and I were working on a piece with the recently elected juvenile court judge who happens to be an African-American mother and wife, and she kind of flipped the system on the head there, Ms. McNeil, because she said that's exactly what she said. She said that justice should be restorative in nature, and she was looking for ways by which, as opposed to just punishing the young people for their offenses, trying to understand how they got there. But now there's two sides to that coin. Some of us know what the problem is, and it's been festering for a long time. But really, how do we, I like your approach, how do we get where they are in a way that they don't feel as though we are judging them or demeaning them in any way, and be able to open up with honest conversation toward the answer and solution? So I like what you're saying, and Pastor Waller, I don't know if you'd like to comment on that, but he was one of our presenters. And this is actually on our webpage, bftinstitute.com. He was one of our facilitators and presenters where he shared some of the work he's done with some others. But it's so important that we know that I don't care how, even if it's a drug addict or alcoholic, they're people. They have a story. And if you want to help them, you've got to be able to come in the right spirit. How key is that, Ms. McNeil?
I think it's very vital, and is definitely is very important. My thing is, who is actually buying into these problems? You know, what are
wow.
who are these individuals? Who are the natural support people that some of these families have in place that's going to help? You know, pretty much help guide and provide effective role modeling measures, because that's
right.
really the key. And being
right.
consistent with all of that, who's involved? Like I mentioned before, recognizing natural support. That doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be family members, but if a child, you know, gets in trouble at school, but he has some positive and, you know, just some really peers to whom he or she looks up to, who are these natural
oh.
supports?
Right.
You know, what is the targeted outcome? Like, why are we actually in the picture? What has happened to the point where, you know, we are actually involved in this family's life? And again,
mm-hmm.
also some of the things that we have to look at is, you know, strategizing effective and beneficial plans. Like, what's going to be the plan of action, and is it going to be a long-term kind of a thing that someone can buy into? So really, I think a lot of these programs that are out here, they're targeted towards, you know, who is actually buying into the problem.
I see. I want to ask a question. It's a somewhat loaded question about how is it that you define intervention? Okay, so let me frame the question for you, and if you don't mind, giving a little thought to it and responding to that. In the context of family despair, both recognized and unrecognized disruptive type behaviors or social values that often are shared within families and neighborhoods, as well as community-wide apathy toward moving progressively, educationally, economically, and things of that nature, how would you define intervention as related to bringing stability to that family?
I would like to think that intervention, when you actually think about the word itself, intervention, it is, to me, it's the influence. It's the influence of, you know, what happens to cause a delay in a specific problem. So what's going to be the influence that is going to cause the delay in a problem within a family home? You mentioned several points such as family disparity, the social values, you know, just the community-wide apathy, and that plays a huge, huge part because it falls with, you know, it definitely falls under the same umbrella. You have to have all of those in order for it to, you know, work effectively. So when you're talking about the family, you know, what makes up one's family structure? Like I said before, sometimes my best friend is a closer entity to me than maybe a brother or sister, you know? So what is the family breakdown? You know, who is in the home? Is grandmother the sole person providing, you know, influence in the home? Or, like I said, unfortunately, there's not a lot of we see a lot of division. You know, I think it's very prevalent that we're seeing there's division in the home. Like the mother and the father are not together, or like I said, grandmother is raising the child, or maybe an auntie or someone has been incarcerated, and so there's a lot of, you know, behavior issues based on some of these situations. So it's almost like you have to look at everything. And then as far as the social values, you mentioned, you know, what does that look like? Without hurting one's culture or his or her personal beliefs, you got to kind of think about what does the people in that home value? What do their priorities look like? I mean, I just think it all goes hand in hand. And then you mentioned community-wide apathy, which I feel like that's being willing to understand and being empathetic towards the cause. Like, you know, what is it that we're trying, what solutions are we trying to get to?
Okay. Wow. You're listening to Talk Straight. This is our special guest, Ms. Lori McNeil. And we have our panelists on, Reverend Ricky Waller. The number is 657-383-0944. You can access us right here online, and we would love to hear your question or comment. Pastor Waller, any comment on that in terms of this whole issue with intervention in a family? Can you do it without intervening in the whole neighborhood?
Yeah, because that actually, you know, it's great what she's talking about, and I think that I was just meditating. I couldn't help but to recall, you know, because it wasn't very long ago when I was that same person that you all are talking about right now. And as an innocent kid, you know, growing up and then becoming captured, it wasn't very long, and it all had to do with the community as a whole. And sometimes just sitting around on the porch, you see things going on, and that happened to me. And so I was so grateful to hear you all talking about this, and I just actually popped my book open on the chapter on the corner. And I helped myself when I thought about how it really actually captures young, innocent people that actually are just out to have fun. And so if you don't mind, I can share this with you on page 10.
Okay.
I just want to share just a little something about it with you. It says, "The trap of the enemy was set years ago, and I was being reeled into a lifestyle. I was fooled into thinking that this was what manhood was all about, hanging with the fellas and having a good time.
Okay.
And that's what started. You know, you're very, very innocent. You're just hanging out with the guys you're growing up with, and suddenly it happens. And you don't even realize it, or I didn't even realize it, and it took a 20-year span before I came to myself and recognized I was just an innocent kid just out having fun and got captured to a lifestyle called street life.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, I became a supplier of my community. A lot of people followed my pattern, and so a lot of people's lives was corrupted as a result of that. So I like what she said. She said we have to meet them where they are. That's one of the things that's missing. We know what the problem is when we know what the problem is. Now, if we don't know what the problem is, we will not be able to meet them where they are. So now, I like the part about the solution, because there is a solution. We need great examples. We need proof. They have to have proof that there's evidence that they too can get free.
Okay.
And I think they deserve it. And what you're doing right now, I believe that is more effective than not, because at least you're reaching out, and she put emphasis on how grateful she was, what motivate her to strive. And I love that, because that just gave me the right now energy that it takes to say, okay, I may not see the results that I'm looking for right now, but if I just could, amen. So I just want to thank, you know, you all for actually bringing up this dialogue. Because it takes, and I think that's what's going to make it effective. I just want to share that, right, because I'm really listening to what you all are talking about, and I think it's great about how to reach.
Well,
I could not. I was the kind of guy. I'm gonna say this, and I'm gonna sit back for a second. I was not the person that brought up my kids, I would say, properly, because I was captured myself, and it hurts. It hurts a lot to know that that's how easy it is for you to get separated from the love that the family deserves. And the kids, my son ended up going to prison because I felt like I wasn't there and I was not showing a great example because of my past. Wasn't intentional, but I just wanted to share that.
Okay.
That's good news.
Ms. McNeil, will you speak to that, please? The many parents who struggle, because it's not easy to say, I don't know, or perhaps I'm ill-prepared when it comes to what's best for your children. How do we convey that so that people don't shut down and lock their doors on you? And, you know what I mean? And hide in Pandora's box.
I think it's really important, like I was saying, who's buying into some of these programs and who's actually looking at, you know, the situation for what it is. I mean, there's still a lot of taboo when it comes to, you know, mental health, you know. A lot of times, you know, just because there's, you know, my mother used to tell me all of the time, there's really no instructional workbook or book on raising your children. Of course, there's lots of different people who think they have the answers, but there's really, not an instructional guide from the time that the child is born to the time that they are, adults. And whether or not they are 21 years or older, they're still going to need you in some type of capacity. So always being prepared. And everybody doesn't always have the parental instincts. You hear about people saying, well, that was my instinct, or it was a gut feeling and things of that nature. Some people don't have those luxuries and things of that nature. And some of those things can actually be wrong. So really there's no particular handbook or there's no guide. It's almost like a lot of people go, you know, day by day, they take it day by day. And they try things, and it's a, you know, almost like anything that you do in life, there are going to be teachable moments. There are going to be hiccups and bumps in the road. Like, and I think a lot of times, you know, some people learn from those mistakes, but sometimes people continue on and they continue to make the same mistake over and over and over again, so it becomes habitual. Then you also have cycles. You know, if a child has grown up in a, say for instance, you know, without a father, they may not know what it's like to have a father in the home, so they're not going to be able to relate. And when they become older, I mean, it's almost like sometimes the cycle, the patterns are passed down unless you break that cycle. So I think it has a lot to do with all of that as well. But like I said, it really goes back to what I said before. I think it's who is actually buying into the problem, who is buying into the wanting to find realistic solutions. In the schools, as a social worker, when I go into the schools on behalf of families who may not know, okay, my child is not doing or performing well, maybe he needs, you know, some support such as a 504 plan or IEP, something in place to help them. Sometimes parents don't know that that's available. So I really sometimes count on the guidance counselors. When you think about the word itself, guidance, counselor, that's just what they should be doing. And over the years, we've seen guidance counselors' positions or their job descriptions of what they have done in the past have now, sometimes because there's been a lack of teachers in the classroom, I've seen guidance counselors have to step down from their role as a guidance counselor to our students and be in teaching instructional kinds of positions. So it's a large breakdown. I think it's really, really important as to who, the types of professional individuals who are actually going into these homes and who are seriously concerned about the demise of our children. I think it's really, really important to know who's on the teams, who's buying into the problems, and who's trying to buy into the solutions.
Can you teach that in a program at a college or university, that type of care and concern, or does that come naturally? I mean, where do you get that from?
Once again, I think it's based on, you know, how you're raised. I can't remember the name of the poem, but I remember my mom had in our bathroom, children learn what they live, and I really if you read, you can Google it. I wish I would have done so, but I wasn't thinking that would even come into the conversation that we're having tonight. But she had that on our mirror growing up. She was a single parent, and with my sister and myself, and we saw that every morning when we brushed our teeth and washed our faces. But as an adult, I mean, I really didn't understand what it meant as a child, but it's true. If you Google that poem, children learn what they live, it is definitely taught. I think everything is a learned entity. When you grow up watching certain things happen in your home, I think unless you yourself or that person who's growing up in that situation, unless they take it upon themselves to change that pattern or change that cycle, It's a learned entity. Go ahead.
I have it for you. May I read this?
Please read it.
Children Learn What They Live by Dr. Dorothy Law Nuttall, PhD. It says, if children live with criticism, they learn to condemn. If children live with hostility, they learn to fight. If children learn with fear, they learn to be apprehensive. Children learn with pity, they learn to feel sorrow for themselves. If children learn with ridicule, they learn to feel shy. If children learn with jealousy, they learn to feel envy. If children learn with shame, they live to feel guilty. If they learn with encouragement, they learn confidence. If they learn with tolerance, they learn patience. If they learn with praise, they learn appreciation, excuse me. If they learn with acceptance, they learn love. Approval, they learn to like themselves. Recognition, they learn what they learn is good to have a goal. If they learn with sharing, they learn generosity. With honesty, they learn truthfulness. With fairness, they learn justice. With kindness and consideration, they learn respect. Security, they learn to have faith in themselves and those about them. And with friendliness, they learn the world is a nice place to live. Boy, you just messed up right there, Miss McNeil.
She had a little bit of a different version, but it definitely, you know, the breakdown of it all really stems down to, you know, what are you living for? What are you learning to do differently with your life? If you don't like something going on in your life currently, what changes are you willing to make it a better situation for yourself? And I made copies of that, and I use that particular poem in some of my sessions with my family, and I break down each line, and I have them read with me. What does this mean to you? Where are you, you know, in this particular segment of your life? And we break it down, and I always make a copy for them, and I laminate it for them, and I pass that on because I remember that was something important to me that I remember very well as a child, reading that every single day. And so I believe, you know, just trying to be a role model, just being a natural support. I let a lot of my families know that I'm not a relative or I'm not a, you know, a friend that, you know, you've known for a long, long period of time. But when I come into your life, I really come into your life and I want to be remembered. I take it upon myself, even if I close the case and I'm no longer working with that family anymore, I take it upon myself to stay involved in that family. I want them to know that just because the few months or however long that I had their child or their family on my caseload and I was getting a paycheck for it, I don't want them to feel that, okay, well, now she's finished on, you know, she's finished with our family and she's moved on, that she doesn't even care about us anymore.
I see.
So I make it a point to buy in. I mean, that's the biggest thing as a social worker that that's my mission. That's my personal mission. What am I buying in?
I have another question that I'd like to ask you, but I'd like to squeeze in this little message here, commercial break. And on the other side of that, Ms. McNeil, I want to ask you about the thing that a lot of us, when I say that, I mean African-American in particular, having a hard time accepting the reality about. Let's briefly hit this this brief message, and when we come back, we'll take that on the other side.
Hey, they call me Poop. I'm from these streets. Somehow, I live to see my 18th birthday. I managed to graduate from juvenile detention to adult prison. People try to tell me I should grow up be a man. But I'm the best man I know. Somebody asked, where I see myself 10 years. Man, I'm just trying to survive these streets day by day.
BFC Institute needs your help. to reach the Pookies across America. Please support our traveling educational lecture series addressing perceived threats to African American males. To learn more, please visit us at bfcinstitute.com. That is bfcinstitute.com. Simply click the red sticker for details.
All right, you're listening to Talk Straight. This is your host, Reverend Dr. Reuben Dockery, and we're delighted to have with us tonight on air Ms. Lori McNeil, mental health specialist in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area of North Carolina, and as well as our panelist, Pastor Ricky Waller, with us again tonight. When we, for the message there, the break, and we certainly hope that those that are listening now or listen later will give due notice and support our calls. Simply go to bfcinstitute.com, learn more about it, and please to support our calls here today. You make your contribution now before December 31st. We can include that in your tax filing for the year 2016. Having said that, prior to the break, I mentioned to our guest that we wanted to talk about something that's hard for African Americans in particular to accept, not only for the children, but for their parents. And Ms. McNeil, I've learned after pastoring now for nearly 20 years, this is an issue within many African American churches. How much do you see a need for there to be focused teaching about the reality of mental health issues and treatment options from a subcultural stance for African Americans?
Okay. Well, just over the past, you know, few years of me being in this industry as a social worker and working with individuals who have, you know, diagnoses or what have you that indicate mental health issues, I've seen that people are usually afraid of what they don't know or what they don't understand. Having a diagnosis or, you know, they can sometimes be misdiagnosed or they're afraid to take a particular medication because maybe, once again, I was discussing, you know, cultural beliefs and things of that nature. But,
right.
You know, I think it's taboo, you know, a lot of times. Even my best friend, you know, she doesn't like to dwell heavily on taking medications for long periods of time. She doesn't, you know, if she has a headache, she'll see if it can, you know, maybe a couple of hours, it subsides. And then if it hasn't, you know, gone away, then she may then take something. But if you think about, you know, diagnoses of a mental health issue, a lot of us are afraid of what we don't know. How is it going to overall affect our capabilities to perform? Is it going to have certain risk factors that maybe the physician didn't explain 100%? Then you talk about even the therapy that goes along with it. We as a culture, you remember your grandmother telling you, you don't air your dirty laundry in the streets or you don't tell what's going on in this house, you know.
That's
right. Is our business. You keep it, you know.
You better not tell
nobody. You better not tell anybody. And so that's pretty much as a, you know, that's something that I have seen over the years.
Wow.
People are afraid due to the fact that, you know, there's different types of illnesses. You know, cancers are more prevalent now than ever before, and they didn't have that back in, you know, the 19. I mean, they probably did, but it wasn't as prevalent. So I've heard people say, well, that might cause me to have cancer, and that's why all these different cancers are coming about. So we're misinformed, most importantly. We're not always properly educated, and we don't sometimes look ourselves to do the research you know, for ourselves. So a lot of the times there's missed opportunities. And so you have a lot of people that are not getting the treatment that they need or being on their medications as they need because of the just the stereotype, the just not being properly informed. And so I definitely think it affects, you know, us as a race.
Wow. Well, now, so Pastor Wall, I'm gonna put myself on the cross here. I spoke with a lady who was having obviously some issues with what appeared to, I'm not a clinician myself, but having worked myself in several facilities and that sort of thing, I can saw the symptoms basically, and so I suggest to her that maybe she would go and talk with her doctor and ask for a consult for counseling. And her response to me, Ms. McNeil, was, "The devil is a lie."
Okay.
I'm not going to let no doctor place that on me. I don't accept it and blah, blah, blah. It became evident to me at that moment that there is clearly a religious and a cultural barrier here to really getting the help that was obviously needed. Is that something you confront a great deal, Ms. McNeil?
I agree once again wholeheartedly. You know, this is just a long history of what we do find self-remedies. Like you have Big Mama, who, you know, she's kind of becoming extinct, but, you know, there's a lot of history where if you have a cold, Big Mama always had, like, a solution, or she had some kind of concoction that she would give you, you know, drink some of this, or, you know, have a hot toddy, put some, rub Vicks on your chest. And so the new school individual, we don't know anything about that. However, then we're going to get into, you know, an area where, you know, people are beginning to just self-medicate. We have a lot of people, like, strung out on different types of substances out here. And, you know, whereas in the 1960s or 70s, you know, marijuana was kind of like a cure for just about everything. But now, you know, that's almost like a gateway drug because there's so many different types of substances out here. I mean, the kids are finding ways to, you know, self-medicate or get high, and it takes away, you know, their feelings of and their emotions of different things. And instead of them talking about it, you know, they would rather get high or they would get stoned on things. So, I mean, I just think over the years, a lot of things have changed, and a lot of people are confused. You were talking about, you know, the devil is a lie. A lot of, you know, people who really believe that, well, I'm just going to pray about it. And they may really have a situation where they, you know, it's going to take a little bit more than just a prayer. They really do need some type of help because they have been misdiagnosed, or maybe they haven't even been diagnosed at all because they are too leery or too afraid to go into, you know, mental health facilities to get the help or the support that they need. So it's a long, we could be on the phone all night over different types of reasons as to why we are where we are now.
Well, we won't be here all night now, I promise you. there is a gentleman, Parham. He wrote a book entitled Dr. Parham. He did with Kwame Adjufu. It was entitled The Psychology of Black. And thought it was a very interesting book. He identified largely what you were mentioning, and that some of the psychotic behaviors and issues that are redefined in the minds of those people who are suffering as being normal and just how we do and how the world should accept us because we're black. You know, and that's an interesting thing. You mentioned the young people who are in a snatch-and-grab mentality today in the streets. And this accounts largely for their engagement with law enforcement that often turns out tragic.
Mm-hmm.
And you if you try to go to the source where they come from, you know, we understand that a parent is your legal guardian. The law provides them certain authorities because, you know, they are the ones typically that gave birth to you. Of course, you have legal guardians who have assumed some of the same rights, but the parent is the one who has the legal custody of you and can make certain decisions that affect your life. And if they're lacking the information and the knowledge, it makes it difficult for you to get it. I'm sorry, Pastor Wallace, were you trying to say something?
No, that's correct. I was agreeing with you right there. Yeah, the parent, you have the overseer. So you say that's right.
But they seem to be the least empowered.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And that is sometimes, I would say, a danger. You know, and I was going to ask, if you will, Ms. McNeil, a question, because this is what I really appreciate about this dialogue here. She said a lot of people, you know, starting to get high. And just the thought of that is prevalent today. I mean, it's major. And young people are experiencing it at a rapid pace. I mean, it's the increase is, and what happens when they don't know, it becomes more interesting. And before they know it, a year went by, 5 years and 10 years, and they got the swing of it by then, and all of a sudden it takes them on to a point of no return. And I personally appreciate being able to share this, because I'm one that kind of holds back. This book has been out since 2013, and I do a lot of funerals. I'm called on to do funerals a lot. God only knows the reason. And this last funeral I was a part of, this guy, when they called me about him, you know, he was a gambler. I wasn't inside the will of God, doing the will of God back then when we grew up, and he loved to gamble. So his sister called me and told me, she said, "You know the one that loved to gamble?" I said, "Yeah, I know him, because we did a lot of that." But anyway, so I shared about gambling is taking a chance. Mm-hmm. And that's what, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. And then I shared with them that one day I took a chance on trying God. And I tried him because I love to win, and that's the way I got free. So this book is entitled Still High. That means there's no more getting high. And this is the greatest high of them all that I've experienced. But a lot of kids don't know anything about that. So they're only going for what they know, and they start to practice what they learn. It's a learning behavior. I think Ms. McNeil said it earlier. It's something that they learn, start to practice, and become really, really good at it. Even though it's not good for them, they become good at practicing how to do it day after day. And it's something about a solution. You get out of the problem into solution. When once you get out of the problem and tap into the solution, the solution is going to supersede the problem. If we can ever just tap into the power of the solution, man. And so I just want to thank her again for bringing this up. So this was a lady, and I'm going to shut up for a minute. There was a lady. This is what she said after the funeral was over. She came up to me. She said, "I told someone that I have your book." I said, "You do."
Okay.
I didn't even mention my book. And surely she got on me. She said, "That's your testimony. You supposed to let people know. Everybody don't know about your book, you know, like that." She said, "Do you have another one with you?" And sure enough, she bought a book from me.
Okay.
And the thought of her sharing that with me reminded me, said, "No, you cannot do that. That's what this book is for. Is for you to let people know about it." And I think it was just amazing that I did happen to have a book with me when she came up to me and said that. So I'm learning now to accept that this book is in existence and it needs to be talked about. And the only way I can get it done is that I have to at least put the effort like I did when I was doing the enemy's work. I put great effort, And I put great effort every day. I didn't even skip days. Was so amazing by it. And I thank God that I'm free from it now, but just wanted to share that right there with you.
All right. And let me just say as a side note, you can get a copy of that book by going to our website, csceinstitute.com, and hovering over the Contact Us tab and look at the back store, and you can find that book right there. And every time you do so, a portion of the proceeds go toward our programs, both locally and nationally, and nationally in terms of our traveling series. Ms. McNeil, you hit something that's critical. And that is when we look at the numbers in the criminal justice system, we look at NAEP's reports on academic deficiencies, and we identify which population of learners and residents who seem to be overly represented in the negative reports, it's clear that we have the African American community, along with the church, with our social and civic organizations, have an obligation. How well, on a scale from 1 to 10, 10 being the best and 0 being the least, how well do you think we are being successful at meeting our obligation there?
Well,
I hope I'm not putting you on the spot by asking that question.
Well, this is just my personal opinion, so I don't think I could go wrong with that.
Okay, all right.
I'm just saying, I think I would like to believe we are closer to the 10 margin than a zero, because that will show that, you know, we're really failing our youth. But I can't say that because I am seeing progress. My son is a freshman at Morehouse. And I will just tell you just really quickly, just biased, me being biased as a parent, when he got there, they had a orientation. They had a new student, program and a platform and things of that nature. But then towards the end of the parents leaving their freshman students, which is all men, Morehouse, for those who may not know, is a HBCU school that is predominantly African Americans, but they're all men. It's an all-male school. So prior to us leaving our son on the campus of the just the illustrious Morehouse College, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. attended school, there are over 900 incoming freshmen, 900. And just to be able to see those men trying to do something, those young men doing something influential with their lives versus being in the streets, with their hands sagging, being incarcerated, not doing anything with their lives. That's 900 students just alone from all different backs of life. Some are more wealthy than others, but then there are some that came from nothing and was able to get there, that has gotten full ride scholarships. And it's not only at Morehouse Colleges that we're seeing the rise of Black American men, and I'm just putting it out there in the atmosphere because I do believe and what you put in the atmosphere will come to pass. But I would like to see more. I would like to see more at our illustrious school, Dr. E. We have a lot of very influential, on the rise young men that are trying to do wonderful things with their lives. And I wanted to say that I think also with some of the churches and a lot of agencies, some that I'm not going to be able to name, but just even with the agency that I currently am working, I'm seeing more youth-involved initiative programs coming about towards trying to implement things, mentoring programs from, my sorority, fraternity,
Okay.
You know, the
okay.
Boys
okay.
and Girls Clubs are still in existence.
Right. Okay. Now, so what I'm – all right. Pastor Wallace, I've always enjoyed engaging Miss McNeil in dialogue because she can go there with you. She can go there.
Yeah, yeah, man.
Now,
let me
push back just a little bit? Now, if I go, just put your fist up, Lord, but let me push just a little bit, okay? I like what you're saying, that there are clear examples of success, and there's much to celebrate. Did I get you correctly?
Yes.
Okay. My son is a freshman at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, studying
mm-hmm.
mechanical engineering. And
mm-hmm.
his dad almost lost his life at 16 on the streets of Chicago in some foolishness, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I hear clearly what you're saying. This was a saving grace for me because it allowed me to get out of Chicago and to step into another perspective of things in life. And so I appreciate it for that and other reasons. But I said that to say this, that while, yes, there are people doing great things, there are young people who have promise and display promise, would you agree that when we look at the national statistics for African-American males, they have a 1 in 5 chance of going to jail as opposed to college? And compared to their white male counterparts, their death rate is higher. Is there work for us to be done on that scale from 0 to 10?
Absolutely.
And where would you put it?
I mean,
okay.
Right.
Okay.
I really agree to there's still work to be done.
Okay.
However, I said, you know, before it was just, you know, I don't know the statistics. Actually, but I would like to believe that there are more and more, and I would like to believe that that's a part to, you know, our African-American president that we've had in office for the past 8 years and his lovely wife. You know, they have put a lot of different initiatives in place for us as a race to be proud of. And now that we're going into another, with another leader of the nation, I think a lot of people have band together so much so that over some of these unnecessary killings and unnecessary violence from the police brutality and just
mm-hmm.
you know the Black Lives Matter
mm-hmm.
programs and the platform for that. I'm just really hopeful. That's just me. Like I said before, I'm just hopeful that a lot of more youth initiatives are being, you know, focused on. I'm just, you know, being proactive and hoping that we will be closer to the 10, the 10 mark on the schedule, on the scale that you mentioned.
Okay.
You know, I would
definitely
see that right now we're just probably just at the half mark, to be honest with you. But I really would like to be proactive and be more a part of the plan to get more or have more availability for visible, even after-school programs. You know, I've owned an after-school program myself, and I was only able to provide services to elementary kids, but I really think it's important for the middle schoolers, even though they think they're too old and maybe going to a youth facility is make them feel belittled or make them feel like they're a baby, because that was just some of the things I used to hear some of the older ones say. But giving them little jobs, you know, how that was, instead of you going home where there's trouble, are you going to, you know, get yourself in some, put yourself at risk because you're trying to be grown. Perhaps you can come and work at some of these community-based youth programs and be a volunteer or maybe that'll be your first time, you know, your first little part-time job or something. So I am very involved with my sorority and some of the local programs and, you know, within my community, and I'm just really pushing for there to be more visible things for, you know, our children to do, so they will be at they're not at risk as much as everything that you said about, you know, the men being, you know, in jail, on their way to jail opposed to going to school.
Right.
Here's the question Pastor, if you will, let me ask that question. What is it that you think you've done with all of the destruction that's going on in our communities for those that are captured? What would you think the solution would be, and how to bring those that's in captivity out? What would you suggest, McNeil? I like everything you said. Congratulations to you.
I just really think a lot of people need to be more more involved. I hear a lot of people say, well, I'm too busy, and I'm not this, and I'm not able to do that, or my money is not right, or this and the other.
Okay.
I just think, you know, if you go to, you know, if you're a member of any church or if you're a member of any type of organization, you know, put these ideas out there and not be a person who's, you know, talking the talk but not walking the walk. I mean, you can minister and you could provide insight to someone in the store. My girlfriend and
That's
I was
right.
at the mall. I love, you know, I'm a woman. I like to go shoe shopping. I like to go to the mall. But there were some little teenager girls walking behind us. We're engaged in our own personal conversation, but they were being they were very disruptive. Their language was abrasive and offensive to me. They were younger than me, but they were cursing like a sailor. And we turned around and we said, listen, this is not how young women present themselves.
Okay.
We didn't know these individuals.
Right,
we did not know
them.
And we told them, if we saw your parents, oh, would you be talking like this in front of your parents? And they looked at us all googly-eyed and like, well, who are you? And they probably said some things under their breath after they left us, but it was a group of five of them. And so if it targeted even one, you've made a difference in someone's life.
Sure.
So you take every opportunity and you seize that opportunity and you try to make things correct. When you see little kids being bad and things of that nature, you know, pull them here to the side. Like, you know, I think a lot of times we're afraid. There's an old adage, it takes a village. Today,
Write
I think we're
down.
Afraid of you. I think we're all afraid to use our voices. And so, you know, people are acting out and doing whatever they want because I think everybody's afraid to say something.
Sure.
And
I
really believe But I also just believe that social media has a lot to do with it as well.
Wow.
You know, what are our kids looking at on these different social media sites? I follow my kids
on every social media
that they're on.
Hey, Lori, hold that thought. I don't want to be rude. We got about 16 minutes before the show ends, and I just want to get this last message in. Can you hold that thought? And because there is another question I wanted to ask you in reference to that. I think that's a
Absolutely.
Great point. Just give me a few minutes here, and then we hit that thing right hard. We hit it right hard.
Hello, listeners. This is your host, Reverend Reuben Dockery. Thank you for tuning in to Talk Straight on Blog Talk Radio. Here, you can share your thoughts as well as become informed about very important social issues confronting society today. Please take the time to visit my website at bfcinstitute.com. That's bfcinstitute.com. To learn more about our efforts to educate, inspire, and empower disadvantaged families across America to improve the quality of life. The best way to stay in the loop of future broadcasts, times, and locations for our traveling educational lecture series and innovative ideas is to become a BFC Institute seminar participant. You may do so by clicking the Join Our Group tab on the home page. I would be delighted to respond to your suggestions and engage you further in most transformative information. Again, thank you for joining us, and I look forward to hearing from you online.
As you can tell, you know, I get a little excited.
fired up
in regards to trying to fix problems or trying to be, you know, whatever I can be, you know, whether it's an advocate or what have you. But I try to, you know, try to get people on board with me. That's just always been one of the things that I really believe that makes the world go round. It's finding individuals such as yourself and sharing those same desires to, you know, change the world. You know, sometimes social workers get a bad rep because a lot of times people think only negativity concerning social workers. Like, I'm not affiliated all of the time with the Department of Social Services, who sometimes remove children from their homes. I try to get people on board with, you know, keeping the families together, strengthening families. Mm-hmm. I believe in that concept. I'm very excited about my position that I have currently because I am doing exactly that. We're actually going into the home. We do work alongside of DSS, who's accustomed to taking children out of their homes and putting them in foster care. And I don't think that that's not always the best way. It can be more detrimental and traumatic on the entire family than it's positive. So I'm not sure if I've answered your question 100%. Maybe Pastor has something that he would like to add. But I really do, as a person, I personally try to get other people on board seeking to do the same types of things that I like to do, such as serving and being of service to others.
Okay. But do you see a willingness and openness and interest on part of residents there in the area?
Okay. Absolutely. When, you know, it's almost like you're going to a function for the first time and you're the only one, you don't know anyone else there. And just breaking down the barriers, you know, being willing to network, being willing to tell my story. I have a story. We all have had some type of trials and tribulations that we have experienced in our lifetimes. Going into some of these homes and working with individuals and being transparent and say, well, you know, I don't necessarily have all of the answers, but let me help you try to figure it out. We together can figure out what this is. You know, like I mentioned before, some parents don't even know how to go into a school and ask for the certain resources that they need for their child. Maybe their child is, you know, has been diagnosed as being dyslexic or doesn't learn exactly how all of the other children in the classroom does. Maybe pulling that particular child out and giving them extra time during a test, you know, but just being a supportive advocate. That's my concept. And I think when you go into the community and you see that if you mentioned, like I mentioned before, meeting them where they are and finding out the common goal, that's what you I think that's a really good foundation.
Well, I tell you what, I'm very interested in coming and meeting brothers and sisters on Wilkerson Boulevard and Allegheny Street and West Boulevard and Tybola. I want to talk to them. I want to see them.
Absolutely. I think people who want help, they will do whatever they need to get the help.
Sure. I agree with you. There are great people who, I think the essence of what you're saying, don't know how to frame their request for help. And sometimes they get locked in the fear of feeling less than, or, you know, as if they're going to be shunned or something like that, to try to go and find answers. So I love what you're saying. Pastor Wall, I'm sorry, did you want to respond to her comment there? You were going to say.
Yeah, Ms. McNeil, I thought you said something about it. It sounds like it has to do with teamwork.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That's what you have to be speaking about, and I like that because I was going to ask you, what do you do when you're doing all those things and things are not changing fast enough? And I mean, you're out here, you're motivated right in the midst of the corruption that's going on, like I am myself, in the city of Nashville, where I stay in the streets as a result of knowing about the streets. And so to ask you this question, I'm greatly motivated by what you have accomplished through your son and what he's doing at Morehouse. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. And my daughter, I won't leave her out. She's at our alumni. She's at our school, Fisk University. So, yes, she's great. Yes, she is.
Congratulations to you and Pastor Dockery for what you all are doing. I'm greatly motivated by that. And now the street life where people are captured and needed someone to be there just in case that miracle takes place at that moment. And if I'm not there, if I'm not concerned, then that's defeating the purpose. So what I'm hearing you saying is that stay in the role that you're in and stay consistent, I believe, is basically, because I'm motivated by hearing this. It's like it can be done. There's a solution.
There is always a solution. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you're energized. You are very energized about what you do. Is that correct?
Oh, she fired up.
I am very compassionate about what I do. And I just say, you know, if something doesn't work, almost like you do a checklist for yourself, for your own personal, what is not working, what can I do differently? And then you bring people on board, you know, ask questions. If you have a community willing, I mean, they have so many different programs and outreaches as willing to donate. Like my family and I tonight, we ate at Panera Bread, but Panera Bread donates whatever they don't use for the evening, and they'll donate their bread, they'll donate whatever, and just, you know, Walmart is a good sponsor. They'll donate things. Have a forum, an open forum, and say that you're going to feed people, or, you know, people love free stuff. I don't care what it is, but have something and just as long as you're putting on there that you're, you know, you have something free, they're going to come, and you have a platform. Make that your platform and ask, what is going on in our community that we that you would like to see differently, and bring in on people who are fully on board with you,
right,
that shares those same philosophies,
okay,
and those same missions. And, you know, you put your heads together. You put your heads together and you,
wow,
brainstorm and try to figure out, what can I do? And it's not about saving everybody, but if you just, like,
yeah,
I say, if you just make a difference in one person's life, you have been,
mm,
successful. You can count,
right,
that as a success story.
Well, that's great,
listen,
guys.
You,
yeah,
know what? Time. I'm so mad at time because it done run out on me.
That's all right. This is very good.
Lori, God bless you for all that you do. I know social workers don't get the praise and the credit they deserve, but thank you for what you do, and keep doing it. And may
thank
God bless
you,
your family, your husband, and your children as you progress, and may he sustain you in your effort there.
Thank
we
you
do
so much. Same to you.
And, I
and
thank
you.
You
too, Pastor. It was a pleasure. It was a pleasure to meet you.
My pleasure. I enjoyed you.
And you have to promise to come back again now, Lori. I know right now you're dealing with some other issues there, but we have to, for sure, down the road. We're looking forward to coming to Charlotte-Mecklenburg.
Absolutely. I think I told
you
that when I last saw you at homecoming. You got to make Charlotte a visit. So make it happen.
Absolutely.
I would love to see you here.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Well,
but thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us, and we'll be in touch with you.
All right. Thank you.
All righty.
Good night.
Yes.
So, okay, good night.
Good.
So, listening audience, we thank you for joining in with us tonight, and we were grateful to have Ms. McNeil to share her perspective on everything. And Pastor Wall, as always, we thank you, sir, for joining us. Time is just not on our side tonight. We have an hour and 30 minutes, and that time is just about on us here. But our next broadcast will air live on this coming Thursday at 7 o'clock Central Standard Time with the Chicago area, and our guest will be a Mr. Gerald Bledsoe, who is a financial specialist in the Chicago area, and we'll be talking about how to raise a successful African-American male. Now, we hear all of the negatives, and we heard our guest tonight talk about the things that she and her husband has poured into her son and her daughter. There are success models. We don't want to give the impression that there aren't some good things going on. Not at all. Mr. Bledsoe will talk about his son, who is actually a mechanical engineer major at Case Western Reserve as well. And we'll talk about some things that he did to get there. But more importantly, we'll learn some successful models, best practices that other parents can use as we embrace one another, as we love one another, and we tell one another with God, all things are possible. With that, join us this coming Thursday at 7 o'clock p.m. right here on Talk Straight with your host, Reverend Dr. Reuben Dockery. And until then, we ask that God bless and keep you, and we will see you then as we move forward.
World is moving much too fast. Mothers have kids they all love. Young men think it's hard to pass all this way. Everybody's trying hard to find a life in a world that's flawed. Thanking God.